Washington, D.C. to demand that Leonard be released. And we want to, Chauncey Peltier was planning to be on the show today, wasn't able to make it, but we are today launching a campaign to write in. I will be getting some really great postcards with paintings that Leonard has done. And you can send that in to D.C. If we don't have those absolutely ready today, we will later in the week. And that should not stop anyone from contacting the White House and demanding that Leonard be freed immediately. If not on any other grounds, at least certainly on medical grounds. This has been ICAST 84, Monday, May 9th, 2016. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Last month, coal giant Peabody Coal filed for bankruptcy. Despite Donald Trump's vow to reopen coal mines if he's elected president, the coal industry needs a lot more than hollow campaign promises to stay alive. This morning, we talk with Clark Williams-Derry, Director of Energy Finance for Sightline Institute in Seattle, about why the coal industry is on the ropes and what does this bankruptcy mean for communities that have been devastated by coal mining and its aftermath. Clark, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we start to actually talk about Peabody Coal and the coal industry in general, I wanted to just start by thinking a little bit about what's going on in northern Alberta right now
with
the major wildfire that's going on. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about this is more than an indication of another dying industry, but it's looking at the horrible ramifications of climate change. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about what's happening and how this reflects it seems to me an inability to connect these kind of catastrophes with what we're doing by putting so much carbon into the atmosphere.
Well, yeah, there's so many sad ironies in this case. I mean, it's clear, it's becoming increasingly clear that as the climate is warming, you're starting to see greater incidences of extreme weather events, of droughts, of floods. To a large extent, these kinds of problems don't always affect the places that are producing fossil fuels. One of the ironies here is that here's a place that is ground zero for the tar sands production in Canada, and those communities are actually being harmed by climate change.
And actually, for people who don't know exactly what we're talking about, we should sort of reference it that the city of Fort McMurray, which is kind of ground zero for the tar sands industry, has been ravaged by this wildfire that's I guess it's over 300,000 acres at this point. So it's starting to rapidly approach the size of the Biscuit Fire here in 2002. And it's burning towards some tar sands operations north and south. And what I saw last night, that over 50% of the tar sands operations are actually shut down right now.
That's right. That's right. And not just that, but there are tens of thousands of homes that have been destroyed, or people that have been moved out of town. It's a real catastrophe. In some ways a humanitarian catastrophe, but it's happening right, as you say, in the center of the tar sands industry in Canada, which is the dirtiest and most carbon intensive form of oil production in North America.
And for me, one of the things that disturbs me, as much as watching these people's lives just be completely unraveled by this, and I'm not sure the percentage of the homes that have been destroyed in Fort McMurray, but it's very large, and I've seen...
I thought I saw 20% this morning.
Yeah.
It may not be tens of thousands, but it's certainly thousands.
It's, well, 1,600 was the number I heard 2 days ago, and supposedly the fire has kind of slowed down a little bit right at Fort McMurray, but it could always flare up again. It's not out. But one of the things that bothers me, as much as thinking about the human horror that's going on right now, is that in the media, and I've read a lot of articles on widespread platforms of what's going on, the only place where I saw a connection made between these fires and climate change was on Democracy Now.
Wow, really? I think that I just was looking this morning, I was doing a news scan, and I'm pretty sure there's a piece in the Washington Post that's starting to even hit the mainstream media. There's a headline that says, "How Climate Change May Be Fueling Canada's Fire Season." And so it's not just sort of the alternative media or sort of the progressive media that's picking up the story. It's starting to reach beyond that into more mainstream media. And I think that that's partially because the facts are starting to become harder and harder to deny, harder to ignore.
Yeah, it took them about a week to figure that out. I mean, actually, and I've been scanning the New York Times for the last week, too, and I saw my first article about it today, and it was a human interest story about how the people in Fort McMurray are going to go back and rebuild their town.
Yeah.
And again, no mention of climate change and no mention about, I mean, they did talk about the boom and bust economy of Fort McMurray. And
I have to assume that those projects are having some real financial troubles as well as obviously ecological troubles, because the price of oil has fallen so low, and a lot of these projects, huge capital intensive projects, just don't make sense financially unless prices are pretty high. Oil prices are pretty high, and as prices have dipped down into below $50 a barrel. It's been a lot harder for these companies to make any money at all. So they're simultaneously despoiling the climate and losing money in the process.
Yeah, well, about 2 years ago, I was up at the tar sands. I visited the Christina Lakes and Ovis operation where they do a process called SAG-D. And I have a sentimental feeling. They were wonderful hosts and they fed me well. So I decided to checked out their website yesterday to see how things were going there. And the fire's about 50 miles from their site. But they have shut down their site. It's only emergent, like the very much required personnel. It's working with a skeleton crew right now.
Right.
I think that's true of just about every operation there. And then Suncor, that's north of
Fort
McMurray, which is actually they think they've kept the fire from actually getting onto their area. Of course, one of the things that's to the advantage of the tar sands operations is that they've taken all the trees off and they've stripped out the peat bog, so there's nothing to burn.
Yeah, that's sad. You know, those places themselves are kind of moonscapes. The tar sands, unlike a lot of other kinds of fossil fuel development, it's kind of like a strip mine. The way coal mining in many parts of the country, they really just turn the landscape into a moonscape in order to get under the ground and get access to the fuels.
Yeah, and actually the SAG-D operation is a little bit different because the actual damage is going on underground. You can't really see it.
Oh, right, of course.
And
right.
So there are. I mean, when I was visiting the Christina Lake operation, it's surrounded by boreal forest. I mean, there's a lot of buildings and there's a lot of these pipelines and things like that, but it doesn't have the completely grotesque metropolis kind of feeling of the open pit mines that the Suncor and the mining operations have. However, what I found interesting is that there's no mention in any of these websites that I visited about the economic problems that they're having, and I'm wondering if some of the shutdowns that they're doing are also maybe using the fire as a subterfuge to actually cut back in operations.
Could be. Could be. You know, it's maybe a little bit too soon to tell, but we'll have to see what happens once the fire dies down, whether the companies decide to sort of keep the skeleton crews and not bring back their full labor.
So I think what we advertised that we're talking about today, which is the bankruptcy
right.
of the coal industry.
Right, of course. Let's turn to that.
But I'm just thinking in a way that what we're watching right now up at Fort McMurray is maybe a harbinger, or I'll take it back. What's happening with the coal industry is maybe a harbinger of what's going to be happening with the oil sands and the deep water drilling of oil and all the other extreme oil, fracking for that matter. So let's talk a little bit about the most recent bankruptcy in the coal industry, and then we can kind of stretch it back, because I was rereading your article about Arch Coal's bankruptcy.
Sure.
And you sort of, I didn't realize how many coal companies had been gone belly up. So
yeah, it's astonishing. I mean, Peabody is the most, probably the best known coal company in the United States. And it's the biggest one to have gone bankrupt. But it's actually the last in the string of about 50 bankruptcies over the past 4 years. Since 2012, about 50 U.S. coal companies have declared bankruptcy. Some of them have been quite small, but in the past 9 months or so, we've seen three of the four biggest U.S. coal companies just completely declare insolvency. They've gone belly up. They've wiped out their shareholder value. They're not going to be able to pay back a lot of their bondholders. And so those three, obviously, Peabody Coal, which we're going to talk about today, but before there's Arch Coal earlier this year, and then last year it was a company called Alpha Natural Resources. Early on, as coal prices both domestically and more importantly internationally fell, you started seeing some of the smaller players go under. But now we've really hit the tipping point where the big guys have completely, given up the ghost. They've gone into restructuring. They hope someday to emerge from the bankruptcy process as leaner, meaner companies. But in the process, they're literally destroying billions of dollars of their shareholders' wealth. Terrible, economic and financial decisions all the way along about what to invest in. But yeah, it's interesting. If there had been one company that sort of embodied or personified King Coal, it would have been Peabody. I mean, who else? What other company has a folk song? It appears in a folk song. I don't know if you remember that John Prine song called Paradise.
Actually, we're going to go out with it today.
Oh, really?
I couldn't resist.
That's right. It's, Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County down by the Green River where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. King Coal had a name, it would be Peabody. And now King Coal has obviously been dethroned or turned into the court jester or whatever metaphor you want to use.
Well, I was just thinking, a few years ago, I was at a Society of Environmental Journalists conference, and there was a panel about oil, coal. I think part of it was about tar sands, part of it was about coal and something else. And there was a guy who was a vice president at Peabody Coal sitting there right in front of me talking about how they were going into Outer Mongolia to develop coal there and to get everybody electrified in Outer Mongolia. And that Seth Bornstein, who's a very well-known journalist who's done a lot of writing about climate change, and he started challenging this guy from Peabody Coal about, why are you doing this? Why are you spreading the carbon footprint of coal? Isn't it time for coal to start receding? And the guy from Peabody Coal said, well, if we didn't do it, somebody else would do it. And so then Seth Bornstein said, well, that's like my kid saying to me that, if I don't do my homework, if everybody else doesn't do their homework, why should I do my homework? Or
right,
vice
right.
versa.
Or like, if all your friends are jumping off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge?
Right.
I think that's pretty typical, not just for Peabody, but for a lot of folks in the fossil fuel industry. They sort of, mollify their consciences by saying, it's inevitable, it's going to happen. This is just sort of like, if we don't do it, somebody else will. That's, I guess, how you put it. To me, that smacks of a sort of a moral abdication that because somebody else punch somebody in the face, you might as well do it too. It just feels wrong to me.
Well, the other thing that I was thinking about is that back then, because this was probably in 2010, I think, when I was at this workshop, and Peabody was already at that time really pushing. They were realizing that the American coal market was dying, so they were in Asia, and they were being in Mongolia was certainly a very extreme part of Asia to be in.
Right.
But I'm wondering if how much that played into their current demise.
It is 100% related to their current demise. I mean, you hear a lot of talk, a lot of rhetoric, a lot of sort of angry noise about, you know, the war on coal in America or Obama's war on coal. What really sunk these companies, though, was terrible financial decisions that they made in 2011 and 2010 to get into the international coal markets in a big way. They put huge multi-billion-dollar bets on essentially endless growth in coal demand in China. And in particular, they were looking at metallurgical coal. Now, just to get sort of nerdy for you for a moment or two, there are two basic kinds of coal. There's metallurgical coal that's used in steel making, and that's a higher quality stuff, and it often goes for super premium prices. And then there's what's called thermal coal, which is used in power plants. Basically, you know, Alpha Natural Resources, Arch, and then Peabody all went into big financial arrangements to buy metallurgical coal mines. They put a huge emphasis on supplying, in particular, China's demand for metallurgical coal. And now, as it turns out, China's demand for metallurgical coal slowed. When you take out a $4 billion loan or $4 billion in debt to buy a coal mine or a coal mining operation that turns out to be worth just a fraction of that, I mean, that steadily eroded their financial situation until they couldn't support the debt load anymore. So notwithstanding all this talk about the war on coal in America, what really sunk these companies was their executives' own hubris, their poor decision-making, their poor and very high-risk bets on becoming a resource colony for China.
So the other thing that was kind of interesting that you pointed out is that while they were losing millions, billions of dollars, they were paying their executives quite well.
It's astonishing to see the correlation between poor performance and high pay. You know, some of the coal companies that are actually doing okay, that didn't put together some of these massive deals to service China's allegedly inexhaustible appetite for coal. These companies, you know, the pay is relatively, you know, it's still exorbitant, it's still high, but like the executives are not paying themselves for their good judgment. It's the companies that made really bad decisions where the executives have been paying themselves, you know, tens of millions of dollars over the years. I mean, I actually took a look the other day to try to see what the stats were on executive compensation for Peabody, and let's see if I can pull them up for you. Yeah, it was over the last 4 years, executive team for Peabody Energy, actually leading up into 2015, they paid themselves about $100 million to their top executives, and the CEO got $41 million. This is not just, you know, small amounts of money. This is sort of like, you know, king of the universe kind of money. They were paying themselves as if they were doing a fabulous job, even as their companies were sinking under their debt loads.
Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, we're talking with Clark Williams-Derry. He's the director of energy finance for Sightline Institute in Seattle. And we're talking about the demise, maybe the demise, at least the current bankruptcy filing for Peabody Coal and other large coal companies that are having a very hard time, I guess, would you say, Clark, facing reality?
I think that's right. I mean, the reality here is that the domestic coal market is in a state of collapse. We really haven't seen this kind of decline in coal consumption for, you know, I think in the statistics since ever, really. In the first quarter of 2016, coal production and consumption were down by about a third compared to last year. And last year was even lower, was also lower than the year before and the year before that. So we've seen this, what had been a sort of a gradual downturn in coal markets turn into a rout. Prices are down. The export markets are dead. Consumption is down. Utilities are turning to other kinds of electricity generation. You know, coal used to, not that long ago, it used to be 50% of the nation's electricity generation, and you know, this year it'll be lucky if it's a third.
Well, there's a lot of action going on right now around the country, well, particularly in the West Coast. There's a series of actions called Break Free from Fossil Fuels. There's one at Anacortes at the oil refinery up there this coming weekend. There's one just past weekend in L.A. And I'm looking, actually, there's also an action coming up to testify against the proposed coal terminal, the Millennium Coal Terminal in Longview, Washington.
That's right.
And that's going to be on May 24th at... Mm-hmm. Let's see, from 1 to 9 p.m. And there's a rally at 4 p.m. organized by Power Pass Coal. So there's a lot of action to, it's really linking all the problems with fossil fuels, not just the pollution and the dust from the coal trains and the particulate issues and all that stuff, but the climate change factor. And the big slogan for the last few years has been keep it in the ground.
Right.
So how does that mesh with the coal industry's desire to keep, in the face of economic disaster, to try to keep their industry alive, and also the fact that at the same time they are responsible for so much carbon emissions?
Right. Well, so one thing that's sort of interesting that happens in a bankruptcy, while a company is still solvent, while it's still trying to pay its bills, it often will try to keep mines open. That might not really make long-term economic sense to keep open. And that's because, you know, once you close a mine, you often have to clean it up, or you may have legacy labor responsibilities, and you have no cash flow from the mine to deal with them. So even if a mine is losing money, it could be even more expensive to close it down. So what's happening in bankruptcies, and some of these bankruptcies, is that some of these zombie mines, the mines that were economically dead but still running because it was so expensive to clean them down, in the process of bankruptcy, as they get into bankruptcy court, some of these mines actually are being shut down. And so bankruptcy, the process of bankruptcy, is one that is actually leading or helping to sort of, you know, wind up keeping some coal in the ground, because some of the uneconomic mines are being shut in. At the same time, though, when companies emerge from bankruptcy, you know, one of the obvious point of bankruptcy is to get rid of your debt. And if you've made taken out huge loans, you floated huge bond issues, and you can't pay them back in bankruptcy, basically, all those debts are written off. They're forgiven. And a company that emerges that may be leaner and stronger in some ways. And so there's going to be this push and pull between mines that are closing and an industry that reemerges where the companies are slightly stronger and slightly in better financial health and can actually wind up potentially investing in new projects. So yeah, this is really going to be hard to see how things play out. Now, of course, the bankruptcy is taking place in the context of this phenomenal and unprecedented demand in domestic coal consumption. So I have a sense, or at least a hope, that you may see more shut-down mines, more shut-in mines, as a result of bankruptcy. But that raises another question, and I think we should probably talk about this for a little while, too, is the whole issue about mine cleanup.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to get into.
Yeah, right. And so as you close a mine, there's a federal law that says you have to clean up after yourself. In fact, this law says that in order to mine at all, you have to set aside some sort of financial resources or some other financial guarantee that you will have the money to clean up after yourself, right? And so that's the been a huge bone of contention in some of these bankruptcy cases, because the companies had used a loophole in the law to avoid setting aside any sort of firm, solid financial guarantees that they would clean up after themselves. That problem, that loophole, is now being put to the test in the middle of these bankruptcies, because it's not clear that there's any money, anybody's going to pony up money to clean up some of these old mines.
So what's going to happen? I mean, I particularly think about the mountaintop removal mining, which I think here in the Northwest, it's almost impossible to even imagine what that looks like.
Yeah,
you can go up to the tar sands, and they'll give you sort of a sense, I guess.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But
right.
That, I mean, and supposedly part of the deal, I understand, when they blew off the tops of those mountains was that there was going to be some kind of reclamation, maybe not what environmentalists would have liked to have seen or people who were trying to farm in those valleys, particularly since the rivers just get covered up with the top of the mountains. But what's going to happen there?
Oh, it's a big, at this point, it's actually a big unknown. I think that the state regulators, particularly in West Virginia, are pretty nervous. The reason that it's West Virginia in particular, because obviously a lot of these companies operate in states besides West Virginia, but West Virginia is one of the states that allows what's called self-bonding. And self-bonding is that loophole I was talking about. In order to mine, you have to put up a cleanup bond or what's called a reclamation bond, and that's sort of a financial guarantee. Usually that financial guarantee is something like, cash put aside into a lockbox, or it's an insurance policy where the insurance company is taking on the risk of cleaning up the after the mine closes. But in the case of self-bonding, essentially the state decides that the coal company is too big to fail, it's got too much money, it's never going to go bankrupt. And so they basically let some of the companies that are largest and in the best financial health set aside no money for cleanup. Now, as it turns out, all the criteria that these states used to judge whether a coal company was actually solvent and actually able, financially able to clean up after itself, those financial criteria were junk because companies like Arch, like Alpha, like Peabody had been approved for self-bonding, had been approved for this sort of cleanup loophole just months before they actually declared bankruptcy. So West Virginia is in a state of, in some ways, a state of panic because they've got all of these mines that they're going to need somebody to clean up, and it's not clear that these companies that are emerging from bankruptcy are going to have the cash to pay for cleanup. Then it becomes the responsibility of the state, and so a state that's already struggling with lots of other fiscal problems and lots of other environmental problems suddenly has a whole new round of problems dumped on its plate.
Now, I'm wondering how that compares with what's going on in Colorado. Or Wyoming, actually.
Wyoming. So the big issue, there actually is very little difference except for in the attitude of the regulators. So in West Virginia, you're starting to see the regulators pushing back against the coal industry, even though, obviously West Virginia is a very pro-coal state. There's some real concern about cleanup, and they're starting to see some objections in the bankruptcy proceedings to the way that some of these cleanup rules are being handled. But in the case of Wyoming, it almost feels to me as though the state regulators are bending over backwards to be nice to the coal industry, to try to allow them to continue to operate in their state even though they don't have a valid cleanup plan or cleanup bond in place. So that's a real trouble when you almost have the state regulators who are cheering on the company that that hasn't been behaving responsibly in the state itself. I have some real concerns that some of the mines, some of these huge open strip mines in Wyoming may be closed during bankruptcy, but there may not be anybody who's willing to pony up the money for cleanup, in which case it would fall back on the state, the states or other, other people to do the mine cleanup.
And who's that going to be? I mean, I can't imagine it'd be either the state of Wyoming or the state of West Virginia.
That's the big question. The big question is, what happens? There's been an interesting case in which a private conservation group in Virginia has started to buy up some coal mines and is going to try to figure out a way of reclaiming them. There's a big question in my mind about whether that's going to make financial sense for them, too, because coal mine cleanup can be hugely expensive. I mean, when Peabody declared bankruptcy, it had something on the order of $1.4 billion in unfunded mine cleanup obligations just sort of sitting out there. We're going to have to see what happens. I don't even have at this point a prediction because really once the largest coal company, the largest private sector coal company in the world declares bankruptcy, you are in uncharted territory and nobody really knows how the law is going to figure out a way to clean up these mines.
Are there any precedents for this? I'm trying to think of some other industry that's gone belly up in the past that had such huge liabilities as the coal industry has.
One precedent actually in the coal industry. There was a company called Energy Futures Holdings. It was down in Texas, and it had a subsidiary that had a self-bonded coal mine. And the Texas regulators, as they got wind of the fact that this company was going to go bankrupt, they actually required the companies to get rid of their self-bond and put up a real, more solid financial guarantee, either an insurance policy or some collateral. I've actually forgotten which one it was. I think it wound up being an insurance policy. So this is the state of Texas. You know, you think of Texas as being a sort of place that's very friendly to the fossil fuel industry, but at least they had the foresight to say, okay, look, this is a problem. Mine cleanup is going to be an issue here. Let's make sure that the company sets aside the resources before the bankruptcy hits for them to make sure that there's a funding for cleanup. So if Texas can do it, you think, well, why not Wyoming? Why not some of these other states that have big coal industries? And the answer is probably simply that in a place like Wyoming, the coal industry looms much larger. I mean, in Texas, coal is, there's a fair amount of coal mining, but it's relatively small potatoes compared to oil and gas.
So the problem has to do with who's actually controlling the government in the
United
States.
I think that's right. I mean, like there's a certain amount of regulatory capture that happens. Regulatory capture is a sort of the academic term for basically the regulated industries being the ones who are kind of helping to make the decisions or set the agenda by the regulators. So you can certainly see that in a state like Wyoming that has been heavily dependent on its revenue from the coal industry, they've done their best to be super nice to the coal industry. Now, what's interesting there is that they think that they're being nice to the coal industry. When I look at the numbers, it appears that they're actually being nice not to their workers or not to the state, not to their state's economy. They're being nice to the coal industry's investors, right? And so when a state regulatory agency does things to be lax about mine cleanup, one of the things to be lax about sort of, worker safety rules, anything like that, what it winds up doing is not benefiting their local communities. It winds up benefiting the investors, the people who put money into big coal in the first place.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Clark Williams-Derry, who's Director of Energy Finance for Sightline Institute in Seattle, and we're talking about the recent filing for bankruptcy by Peabody Coal and its kind of ripple effect throughout the economies of the states, probably the economy of the world. You mentioned earlier that the people who are going to get really hit hard by this are the shareholders in Peabody Coal. And
well, yeah. Anytime a company declares bankruptcy, the shareholders are either wiped out or virtually wiped out. So you would think that the shareholders in a company like Peabody would be furious beyond belief with the executive team that got them to this point. But as far as I can tell, I mean, the shareholders, there's been no shareholder revolt against, say, the exorbitant executive pay that the top brass at Peabody Energy paid themselves. You would think that there'd be shareholder resolutions about, well, we can't let these guys continue to earn their huge salaries because, they're obviously not worth the money that we pay for them. So far, there's unsurprisingly, given that these things are controlled sort of on Wall Street, the boards, the shareholders, whatever, tend to give rubber stamps to high executive pay.
I'm kind of curious, actually. One time I was going through all the companies that the mutual funds that I have invested covered, and I think this was a couple of years ago. I noticed Arch Coal was there. I complained to my investment counselor, and I think Peabody might have been in another one of these funds.
Yeah.
And I think that actually, and this may be part of their problem, I think that I'm pretty sure the fund that I am invested in divested of coal over a year ago.
I think
a lot of these mutual funds sort of saw the writing on the wall. And I'm wondering if that also has an effect on the coal companies when large mutual funds are divesting in them.
Mutual funds, I mean, what probably has a bigger effect, at least at this point, is the decision by banks not to give financing to coal and, to coal companies. And that's actually starting to take place all over the world, where you're seeing big international banks, investment banks and that sort of thing, putting coal on the blacklist. And that is actually making it much harder for many coal projects to get money. I mean, in effect, the coal industry, just about every mutual fund is now more or less divested from coal because coal stock prices have fallen so low. I mean, basically, you know, if you bought probably a portfolio of just coal stocks in 2011 at the height of the market, if you bought $100, maybe it's worth 50 cents now. You know, if you bought $100 worth of stock, you know, prices have fallen so low and across the entire industry that the only coal companies that are sort of left standing and they're still, you know, making money are relatively small niche coal producers or producers that have some other business, like oil or gas or something like that, or parts of utilities. So if you are a coal investor, you have essentially been wiped out. It was a terrible, terrible investment. I mean, like everybody who says that, you know, people who, you know, some of the divestment movement doesn't know what it's doing, anybody who listened to the divestment movement on the coal industry would have been saving lots and lots of money. They would have been doing much better just staying completely out of coal. Now, I think that's actually starting to be true for oil and gas as well, as oil and gas prices have been falling. You've seen starting to see the wave of bankruptcies in the oil and gas industry that's in the way you have with coal.
Well, actually, I wanted to kind of wind up the show by doing, I want to do some comparisons now again between the lessons that the extreme oil and gas extraction companies can learn from the coal industry and what the coal industry can maybe be learning from what's going on in northern Alberta right now with the big fires when we look at the kind of environmental devastation that they incur. So as far as the bankruptcy precedent, do you think that the oil and gas industries are looking at what's going on with coal and seeing that they could be next?
Well, I mean, they already are next. I mean, for a lot of them, I mean, I think I saw a headline earlier today from Reuters saying that the oil and gas, particularly oil bankruptcies, now sort of rival the big telecom bust in the 1990s. It is really a financial bloodbath out there for the energy industry. And the lesson that they should be learning from this is that these trends, these financial trends, are not going to turn around. They're not going away because they are driven fundamentally by changing technologies. It's not like it's not like something that's just sort of a blip. But as the cost of solar and wind are coming down, they're eating into the baseload share that coal used to play. As the cost of battery rates is coming down, you're going to start to see more and more deployments of renewable energy. And at the same time, on the flip side, fracking, which also carries all sorts of environmental risks, fracking has brought down the cost of oil and gas so low that some of these extreme drillers, the people who build tar sands or who are trying to do deep water drilling, they just can't compete at today's prices.
But actually, isn't fracking actually sort of undermining itself, because it's expensive to frack oil and gas, and when they manage to bring the prices down so low, my understanding is that it becomes not even financially feasible to continue to frack.
That's exactly right. That's what's happening right now. Is that, and that's what sort of spawned this wave of bankruptcies. It's not just the higher cost producers who are going under, it's some of the fracking companies that are having troubles as well, because, frankly, it's sort of like they become victims of their own success, although I'm not sure I'd like to call that a success. But the prices have come down so low that pretty much anybody who makes an investment in the fossil fuel industry right now has got to be very, very nervous. Sort of financially, it has been turned into what looked like just a few years ago as sort of a sure thing. It's now just a minefield. You have to be very, very lucky to keep your shirt.
Yeah, I wonder, and I'm thinking about Fort McMurray right now, but then there's all those communities in North Dakota and eastern Montana that have become boom towns, very similar to Fort McMurray.
That's right.
And I wonder
Williston is the one in North Dakota.
Right.
It's like where home prices just collapsed as drilling activity has fallen.
And actually, they're instead of having a cataclysmic fire to bring them down, it seems like they're having the fire is one of a financial nature rather than of a physical nature.
Yeah, exactly. It's a financial forest fire that's affecting the entire oil and gas industry right now.
So what is your thought? I mean, do you see that the oil and gas industries are on their way out? I'm thinking about Donald Trump campaigning in West Virginia right after Hillary Clinton kind of stumbled through her trying to explain why we need to get off of coal there. And so there's that image. There's the image in Wyoming of people absolutely adamant about maintaining their connection to coal. And then in Fort McMurray, people, you know, we're going to rebuild our city. We're going to continue to extract tar sands from the pits. And so it seems that there's a mindset that really needs to shift.
It's a mindset, and it's something that I think it was Upton Sinclair said, you can't get a man to understand a thing when his livelihood depends on his not understanding it. And of course, that's sort of gendered language, but I think that's a quote. But the idea that the boom times, the good days are going to come back anytime soon, is rooted in hope, it's rooted in fear, but it's not rooted in a sort of a sober assessment of the technological trends. I mean, solar is going to keep getting cheaper, wind is going to keep getting cheaper, energy storage is going to keep getting cheaper, and those things are going to help drive coal demand down, even as low-cost natural gas is going to make it harder and harder for coal to compete. And, you know, all this talk about the war on coal is kind of, you know, just, you know, a longing for a past when the technology was different, and that technology is not going to go away.
Well, I'm thinking about how the whole West is really built on boom and bust, and you'd think that after over a century of boom and bust cycles and people, you know, making lots of money and then losing their shirts or whatever. And that Fort McMurray is really kind of like it epitomizes
right.
That whole mentality, that whole phenomenon. Do you see any turn of the tide here where people are starting to appreciate that we can't rely on boom and bust any longer?
You know, I wish I could say I saw that very clearly. You're starting to see bits and pieces of it. You know, Appalachia, I think, has been facing the downturn of coal for longer than anywhere else, and they really are, you can sort of see signs of trying to figure out a way of creating an economy that's past coal. You know, there was a big sort of round of attention that came to I guess it was miners turning into coders. Computer coders, because a lot of mine workers are actually, you think of them as sort of like, you know, holding a shovel in their hands. At least that's what Donald Trump had as his pantomime for coal, a coal industry worker. But they're actually high-tech workers. I mean, they're working with complicated machinery. They're often engineers or have some engineering background or training. And so, you know, coding might be actually a good fit for them. But, you know, I think those sorts of things, that the sort of recognition that fundamentally, the fossil fuel economy has shifted, that technology is changing, that is coming, hitting people very slowly. People are taking a long time to sort of realize that over the past, you know, 2 to 3 years, we've seen some sort of a turning point or a tipping point in the finances of the global energy industry, where the old ways of doing business just don't make any sense anymore.
Well, it's been really great talking with you, Clark. And
thank you for having me. I appreciate you having me on.
Right. And we'll check in again, because I'm sure you're going to be coming up with some more good facts and figures about the demise of many energy industries.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of hard to open the news without seeing some sort of new sign of that.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And I want to let people know that if you want to speak up against big coal, you can do it on May 24th, which is 2 weeks from tomorrow, at the Cowlitz Expo Center, which is 1900 7th Avenue, Longview, Washington. It's the hearings go from 1 to 9 p.m., and there's a rally at 4 p.m., sponsored by Power Pass Coal. And you can also, there's trainings if you want to learn how to prepare public testimony or written comments. And the meeting is going to be at the Multnomah County Library at 801 Southwest 10th Avenue here in Portland on Monday, May 16th from 6 to 7 p.m. or 6 to 7:30 p.m. And the, there's a very long website. But anyway, we'll have a link to this on the Locus Focus website. So You've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. And if you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, my guest is Jennifer Ackerman, author of The Genius of Birds. My engineer is Kate Welch. We're going to go out with some music by John Prine, the song that Clark mentioned earlier, Paradise. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
When I was a child, my family would travel down to western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. Well, sometimes we'd travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Edry Hill, where the air smelled like snakes and we'd shoot with our pistols, but empty pop bottles was all we would kill. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away. And the coal company came with the world's largest shovel, and they tortured the timber and stripped all the land. Well, they dug for their coal till the land was forsaken, then they rode it all down as the progress of man. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the...
And it is 11 a.m., you are tuned to KBOO Portland, and coming up is Health Watch. Today, host Ellen Goldsmith has a guest in the studio, naturopathic physician and herbalist Glenn Nagel. At 11:30, we are going to hear Progressive Spirit. Host John Shuck interviews author and atheist activist John Loftus about how to defend the Christian faith, advice from an atheist. And thank you, KBOO members, for helping us get very close to our goal in our recent membership drive. Your support is awesome.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, We're From Here, will play Thursday, May 12th at 7 p.m. We're From Here is an award-winning film about three dancers that were born and raised in Portland, William J. and House of Aquarius.